Cybercriminals attacked an infiltrated City of Atlanta servers last week. It is the work of ransomware, a malware that freezes information and holds it until the target pays to regain control of its computers. Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms condemned the attacks.
This is much bigger than a ransomware attack. This really is an attack on our government, which means it's an attack on all of us.
Let's get an update on the cybersecurity attack in Atlanta. GPB News reporter Emily Curitan is here. She has been following the story. Emily, good morning.
Good morning, Tony.
What is the latest on this cyber attack?
Well, the latest is actually that the city was warned about this months ago. So an audit was exposed yesterday by CBS 46, a 41-page document showing that the city had no formal processes in place to prevent cybersecurity risk, and that there were big holes in their security measures, and that city employees either got used to them or simply didn't have the time and resources to deal with them.
The city was warned.
The city was warned by an auditor who told CBS 46 that they didn't even get a response to their audit for months after they sent it.
So that talks about that. That implicates this administration and the previous administration as well. So give me the dimensions of this. We're talking about a cyber attack.
We're in day seven now of a ransomware attack that began very early Thursday morning. And my understanding is that this attack has taken city data and encrypted it. And now, rather than like a phishing scheme or a malware, there are actually bad actors who are demanding a ransom, $51,000, which is about 6 bitcoins. And it's just low enough, you know, where the city might want to just pay it and get the monkey off their back. We've seen that before. Recently, Leeds, Alabama was a small town hacked, and the ransomware, the bad actors there demanded $12,000, and the city, sort of at their wits' end, just paid them to get the encryption key to get their data back.
So do we know whether or not the city is going to pay, is thinking about paying, what the city's thought process is on taking this on?
We don't know exactly where they're at now. As of Monday, there was a media briefing where Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms said that nothing had been ruled out. So I read that to mean that the paying the ransom is still on the table. They're working with a cybersecurity firm called SecureWorks and a forensics team, the FBI, Georgia Tech, and the Department of Homeland Security. So the city's response right now kind of breaks into two camps. There is the IT response and trying to deal with how do we get this data back or how do we negotiate with the bad actors. And then there is a whole other camp of people who are trying to make the city's business run manually with pen and paper. For the seventh day now,
Is that what's happening now? People are having to access the system?
It's department by department. So yesterday, city employees were allowed back onto their email accounts and on their computers for the first time. A lot of departments are still being manually processed, though. And I called today, just this morning, the municipal court has been turning people away, hundreds and hundreds of people, since Thursday. So what kind of backlog that's going to create has yet to be seen.
Do we know what data has been frozen? What's been compromised? Are the hackers, do they have the ability to siphon accounts if they want to?
We are told that the city does not believe personal or financial information has been compromised. In the immediate aftermath of this attack, anyone who had done business with the city was warned to check their credit report and look for suspicious activity. But now the city has actually tweeted out multiple times that that does not appear to be an issue.
Okay, so let's bring another voice into the conversation. Atlanta isn't alone in trying to get to the bottom of its cyber attack. This week, city officials in Loganville urged residents to monitor credit reports and bank accounts. That's after a hacker reportedly may have accessed a city server containing social security numbers and banking information. For more on what we can do as individuals, what cities can do to avoid being hacked, let's turn to Georgia Tech professor Milos Pervulovic. He joins us now. Milos, good to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
How does this happen?
Well, I mean, it's a traditional, you know, cyber attack with a new twist on how to make money out of it. So basically,
a traditional cyber attack.
Yeah, I mean, there's
nothing new in this, is what you're suggesting.
There is nothing new in hacking into computers.
Yeah.
But over the last, let's say, decade, you know, the model for these attacks has evolved from kind of claim to fame for hackers. I mean, it used to be like, you know, they break into something and then, you know, they're kind of like now important in the hacker community. It's turned into how do I make money out of hacking into something? And this, you know, ransomware is one of the approaches on, you know, how do I monetize the, you know, I hacked into somebody's system.
Right, right. So Emily's going to stay with us. And Emily, when you've got a question, because you know the story better than I do, just jump on in.
I do have a question, actually, right off the bat here. Mm-hmm. Miloš, are cities and government entities particularly vulnerable to these kinds of attacks or particularly desirable as targets?
Well, the desirable targets are always those that, for especially for ransomware, are those that, you know, will value the kind of, you know, basically they value their data enough that they are maybe willing to pay. So, for example, for a person, it's, you know, you encrypt their data, it's like, okay, how much do they value their personal photos and stuff like that? But for a city who, you know, every day that goes by, there is a disruption in service, you know, they are maybe motivated to pay. And the attackers know this, so they will go after entities that might be willing to pay.
So how do individuals who are doing business with the city, I'm thinking about all of us who do business with the city, water bills, whatever, how do we protect ourselves? We can't assume clearly that the cities are protecting our data.
Well, I mean, yes, but, you know, when you're paying water, if, for example, you have this auto-pay feature that, for example, I'm using, and, you know, of course, if the hackers wanted to get that information, so clearly if that information was encrypted on the system that was hacked, then obviously somebody might have gotten it out too. Traditionally, that doesn't happen for ransomware attacks simply because the attacker is trying to maintain their reputation. Basically, if you do this, you know, you hack into somebody's system, you extract ransom, and then you also sell the data on the black market, the next system that you hack, they might not be willing to pay because they know that that's not the end of it, right? So you're kind of trying, I mean, as an attacker, you're essentially trying to maintain a reputation for, yes, you pay, you get your data back, and that's the end of, that's the end
really?
Of the story. Yeah.
That, like a hacker's code of honor.
Yes.
It's more like, you know, it's not really the code of honor. It's basically that's how they make money. So they don't want to jeopardize that, right? So there is nothing fundamental that prevents them from stealing the information. But traditionally, if you do ransomware, you don't also steal the data and sell it.
So I've got a couple of questions. One for you, Emily. Do officials in Atlanta know who is responsible? Have they identified the actors here responsible for this hack?
Yes. That came out on Monday that the city and the forensic team they're working with is aware of who this is. They're familiar with the kind of attack, and they don't think it's prudent to disclose it while, as the mayor put it, we have an active hostage situation on our hands.
My goodness.
So she likened the data to hostage. Miloš, I have a question for you, and I asked the mayor this on Monday. Presumably, a big system like the city of Atlanta would have backups of its data. And if someone steals your data, I mean, there's a risk that they could use it for a malevolent act, but if they're just trying to make money off of you and you have a backup, couldn't you just say, you know, no, I'm not going to pay because I have that data backed up? And when I asked the mayor if they had it, she said, yes, we have backups, but we're not sure if our backups are compromised too. How do we make sense of that?
Yeah, so I mean, for ransomware, because essentially somebody is holding your data hostage, as in the data is encrypted, you cannot access it anymore without the attacker giving you the key to decrypt it back. So a backup traditionally would work for this, right? You say, okay, I don't care that I lost the data on this system because I have a backup. I'm just going to restore it and be done with it. The problem is the backups are always kind of, I mean, usually the backup is behind the system. So essentially you will lose some amount of, for example, if you did like water bill transactions and stuff like that, you know, the backup will not be up to the, you know, this second. It's also going to be disruptive, basically. Now you have to shut down the system, reinstall it, you know, bring the backup. So it's going to be some time, and you don't know what you lost in between. There are systems that you know, kind of backup on a much more proactive basis and so on, but also depends on, like, where did you keep your backups? Was it on a system that might have also been compromised?
Oh, my.
And so on. And you don't know that until you try.
How does malware, I'm trying to get the terminology right here, right? How does malware differ from ransomware?
Ransomware is a kind of malware. So malware is basically all kinds of bad software, let's say. I mean, malware is really like mal is kind of for bad and ware is from software. So essentially malware is any kind of bad software, and ransomware is a kind of bad software that does what this did, which is encrypt your data and then, you know, hold the data up for ransom.
Okay. Are cities easy marks for these kinds of cyber attacks?
Any entities that like very big corporations, for example, do a lot to protect their data, and they have multiple backups and they have fallback schemes. So basically, like if my system gets in any way inconvenienced, you know, there will be another system that takes over almost immediately, and so on. And then, you know, us private citizens, kind of what really protects us is that our data is usually, no, not that worth to the attacker. Essentially, I mean, somebody can steal my bank accounts, but it's a lot easier if you can steal thousands of bank accounts, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And cities are in this probably position. I mean, depends on the city and the investments in the infrastructure and so on. Cities are in this position where they don't have the budget of like federal government or, you know, huge companies, and yet they are in this position of holding, you know, information about a lot of things and needing to maintain some services like, you know, paying bills and so on.
Okay, Emily, last quick one for you. What's the question you want an answer to from the mayor, and the next time the mayor makes herself available to talk about this?
I want to know what condition the machines were in before the attack took place. Were they up to date on their patches? This audit certainly indicates that the city, the embarrassment meter for the city seems to be rising in terms of the big question of, were they particularly vulnerable, or is this a new, fluid, extremely dangerous kind of cyber attack? It's looking more like the former, but we don't know yet.
Emily, appreciate it. Emily Kuratin, GPB News correspondent, and Miloš Pravulović. He is a professor with Georgia Tech's School of Computer Science. We want to share a story of wrongful incarceration, eventual freedom, and abiding hope. In 1985, a restaurant outside Birmingham, Alabama, was robbed, its manager shot and wounded. He identified Anthony Hinton as his assailant, and police pinned two other robberies of fast food restaurants on Hinton. In those incidents, the store managers were shot and killed. Anthony Hinton was 29 years old at the time, and he spent the next 30 years in prison, mostly on death row. But with the help of civil rights attorney Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative, Hinton was released in 2015. His book, The Sun Does Shine, describes his ordeal. He's speaking tomorrow in Atlanta. Anthony shared his story with On Second Thoughts, Adam Ragusea.
Were you thinking about how you would eventually tell your story one day when you were on death row? Were you writing this book in your head? Did you think you'd be able to give the world your side of this story at some point?
Well, I had hoped so. You know, one never knows when they're dealing with the legal system. I did know that the legal system had made, I would love to be able to say, a mistake, but the legal system didn't make a mistake on my case. I went to death row simply because I was born black, male, and poor. I went to the death row because the prosecutor was racist. But once I got to death row, I began to think about everything that my mom had taught me about fairness, compassion, and everything. But I never thought that I would end up on death row for a crime that I didn't commit. I didn't even think the races of the racist person that stand for justice would openly put an innocent man on death row. But make no mistake about it, they did, and they knew that I was not the person that had committed that crime. In fact, one of the detectives told me, he said, I don't believe you did it. He said, but you'll do. And I looked at that detective with tears coming down my eyes. And another detective told me, say, listen, we really believe you didn't do it. But since y'all are always taking up for one another, take this rap for your homeboy. And I told that detective, there's not a homeboy in this world that I would take a rap for like this. And so they knew that those bullets didn't match. They didn't care. Was quoted as the prosecutor once said, we didn't get the right one, but at least we got one off the street.
It was your own defense team. You write in the book
Absolutely.
That your defense
Absolutely.
Attorney told you, all y'all blacks always say you didn't do something. That was your defense
Yes.
attorney that said that to you.
Absolutely. You know, it was like the good old boys had got together and decided that we would do just enough to make the legal system seem like we went through the proper procedure. But how would you feel if your attorney come up and don't even speak to you and just look at you and say, I didn't go to law school to do pro bono work. And I never will forget it. I looked at him and I said, would it help if I told you that I was innocent? And he looked at me and he said, the problem with that statement is all of y'all is always doing something and then saying you didn't do it. And this is the attorney then that I knew that I had to somehow try to win over and make him like me where he would at least give me the representation that I deserved. But it didn't work, and, you know, and he went out and hired a blind ballistic expert. And I often tell people the truth. Had I been on the jury, I would have found me guilty because the expert that he went out and got was no expert indeed. And what bothers me more than anything is that the judge allowed this so-called civil engineer, the judge qualified him as being one of the best expert that you could get. And so I knew then that once they start cross-examining him, that I would be found guilty. And it cost me 30 years of my life.
We're speaking to Anthony Hinton. When he was 29 years old, he was wrongfully arrested and convicted for some murders outside of Birmingham, Alabama, and he spent the next 30 years in prison, most of that on death row. He was released in 2015, finally, when his conviction was vacated, and his new book about the experience is called The Sun Does Shine. Anthony, I don't know why this is the detail that sticks at me. It just does. In your book, you write how you needed this racist defense attorney. You considered him your Rocky. He was your Italian fighter. And mm-hmm. then and you were Apollo Creed. And then you write about how 10 years later, I imagine in prison, you saw Rocky IV for the first time. And tell people what you thought when you saw that film.
Well, when I saw it, you know, you always imagine that your attorney will decide that he will give you his best. And realizing that he had made a mistake, and I needed this attorney because I couldn't afford an attorney. And as I said earlier, I had to somehow try to win this attorney over to get him to like me. It wasn't about being able to pay him where he come from. I could tell that this attorney was racist. I could tell that this attorney had put every black man in this box, and as far as he was concerned, I was no different, no better. I had went out and did a horrible crime, and he had been asked to represent me. And he didn't want to do it, but the judge told him to do it. And so my way of thinking was, come on, let me be your coach. Let me bring you to victory. Instead of you bringing me to victory, let me try to show you who I really am as a person. Don't look at me for my race. Look at me for an individual. Get to know me, and then I had hoped that once he got to know me as an individual, as a person, he would say, you know what? He's different. He's a person that I can work for, a person that I would give my all for. And I really thought that I could win him over. And when I saw Rocky, you know, I finally said to myself, this is the dream. This is what I had imagined that my attorney would do. He would win my freedom, and we would run up some steps somewhere, and we would throw our hands up in victory and say, hey, you fought a good fight and we won. And so it just brought back some bad memories when I seen it, and I seen that it wasn't going to work out that way. And I can't even imagine to tell you how it feel knowing that before you even go to court, you already been judged. You already been found guilty. The only thing now left is the sentence. And every judge and every lawyer for the prosecutor and even my own lawyer, I felt betrayed. Not only me, but they betrayed justice. They betrayed and made a mockery out of the system. And therefore, I don't know how anyone could ever believe in the system again after reading and getting to know my case. I just cannot understand how a simple case like this that dealt with ballistics, how an attorney could go out and hire a one-eyed, blind civil engineer. But yet the system allowed this to be who I needed, and they said he was no more than others, and he read and got magazine. And I never will forget when the judge said that, well, he getting magazines and he know more than the average person. I kept thinking, if I was to get medical journal sent to the house, would that give me the right to go out and perform open heart surgery? Because that exactly what she was saying. Just because this man get a magazine talking about bullets and guns, he was qualified. And my lawyer went out and hired this man. My lawyer never did give me his best. And I want to say to whoever is listening, I don't care whether you're being paid or not paid, you chose this profession, and you should give every client your best. And sometimes your best won't be good enough. But at least you could go home and say, hey, today I gave Anthony Ray Hinton, today I gave this lady, this man, my best. And I tell you the truth, I never did receive my attorney best. I seen my attorney twice in the year and a half that I sit in jail, and I wanted so badly to believe that my attorney would do what he's supposed to do. And even with him making the racist statement that he had made, I still wanted to believe in him. But more important, I wanted to believe in this system that my mom had taught me to believe in. And I'm going to be honest with you. I don't believe in the system. And I'm going to be honest again with my viewer. It's hard for me to believe that a white man would give me his best. And I can't tell you how hurtful that is for me to sit here and say, because I believe that justice should not be about race. Justice should be about that word, justice.
Yeah, you write in the book about how, again, you were seeing your lawyer like he was going to be your Rocky and you were going to be his Apollo Creed. And then you say that 10 years later, you actually got to see Rocky IV when you were in prison. And you write, it made me glad that I hadn't known that Apollo Creed died in the movie while Rocky stood by and watched.
I kept wondering, did he really understand it? I had been sentenced to death. Did he really understand that this is a case about the death penalty? This is a case that, no doubt, if I be found guilty, I'm going to be sentenced to death. Did he care enough to give me his all? Did he care enough to say, I'm going to fight for my client? Because if I don't, he's going to be sentenced to death. And there's a great possibility that he would be executed. I thought and hoped in my own heart that he would care enough to say, hey, I'm not going to let this man die on my watch. But he didn't. And I wanted so bad to believe that he would be my Rocky.
You've been out of prison for about 3 years now. You write in the book about how your time in prison, you went through quite an arc. You started off very angry. You didn't speak for 4 years. But eventually, primarily through your faith, you really were able to adopt a very positive mindset that got you through hell, as you put it. You've been out of there for 3 years now. How are you feeling?
I feel good. I have great days and bad days. People to understand that 3 years will not erase 30 years. And for some reason, I still find myself on death row on occasion. I still wake up every morning at about 2:45, and I was woken up every morning for 30 years at 3 a.m. for breakfast. Now I wakes up out of pure habits because that's the time I had to get up in order to eat breakfast. I find myself showering just like I did when I was locked up every other day on a certain occasion. I still live in prison some days, and it feels like I'm just on a furlough. My mind takes me back, especially during the week of an execution. No matter where I am, no matter where and who it is, I be on death row because I know exactly what that week is like, the week of an execution. I know exactly what the condemned is being told, and I know that every inmate that he come across is trying to give him hope. And I sit here in this house, and people don't understand that my heart is heavy, and I'm imagine being in that cell, and I know exactly how the guards are treating him, and they treating him this week like a human being, where for the last 10 years, 20 years, no matter what he asked him for, it was always no. But the week of the execution, the guard will go out his way and treat him like a human being. And I wonder sometimes what it is about death that even makes your enemy love you just before they execute you. And so I go through pure hell someday because of what they did to me for 30 years.
It's interesting. As I talk to you, I realize, well, it's evident in your book as well, that you, Anthony, you're a very intelligent man, and you're very charismatic. And I wonder about all of the people who may have been wrongfully convicted in other cases, and they don't have the tools that you have. They're not as effective advocates for themselves as you are. And I wonder what happens to them.
I'm trying to be the sports person. We can sit here all we want to. We can blame the system. But I blame the voters. I blame the people. Every day, the government kills in your name. And the government kill innocent people. The government kill innocent people knowing that they innocent. But society don't care. Society say you had a trial and you was found guilty. I was found guilty by a jury that the judge told me, a jury of my peers. Now, they got it wrong. Do we really want to kill innocent people? And I often tell people, the only way we will never kill innocent people is that we don't have a death penalty. And the death penalty, the politician need to stop lying to the voters and telling them that they are more safer by having a death penalty. You're no more safer with John Doe being dead than you was when he was alive and locked up in prison. But the problem that we have in this system is that the system is not fair. People see this statue and she got this blindfolds around her eyes, but I promise you, she can see. She know what race you are. She know what college you went to. She know how much money you have in the bank. She know what neighborhood you live in. She know everything she need to know about you. And if you find yourself in her courtroom, she have already put these things together and it have already been determined whether you're going to be found innocent or guilty. That is a fact. We live in a system that is badly flawed, and I don't understand why people will not wake up and say, hey, too many innocent men and women are being exonerated in this country. How long do we need a death penalty? Because if you truly care about innocent people die every day in this country. I, had it not been for the civil rights attorney, Brian Stevens, who stepped in and worked diligently and worked every day, 7 days a week, nonstop for 16 years to prove my innocence. If it had not been for him, let me put it in a way that it should be said. Had God not sent this man to me, I surely would not be here talking to you, because the state of Alabama had every intention of killing an innocent man. And they was going to do it in the name of justice. Now, I like to ask the world, I like to ask everybody that's going to listen to this, where is my justice? Where do I go to get justice? Who do I see to get justice? Because it seemed like no one cared that I've been locked up in a cage like an animal for 30 years. And every day people look at me and they think I'm fine. But I'm not fine. Because I live it every day. And I pray to God that one day that this would just be a blank memory. I don't have no memory of where I've been for the last 30 years.
That's former death row inmate Anthony Henton speaking with my colleague Adam Ragusea. Anthony's memoir is called The Sun Does Shine. Marvel's Black Panther recently passed the $1 billion mark at the box office. It is just one example of important changes we're seeing in superhero films, the rise of superheroes of color. Now, the film was produced in Atlanta, but it is not the only black superhero project to call Georgia home. So does the CW's Black Lightning. Actor and rapper Marvin Jones plays the villainous gang leader Tobias Whale, and he joins us now from our studio in Culver City, California. Marvin?
Hey.
Good to talk to you.
How you guys doing? Hey, good to be here, man. Thank you for having me.
Your showrunner says, I didn't want the hero of the show to be fantastical, because so many people out there are suffering, and I felt like they needed a hero.
Right.
So describe the tone of your show for people who have yet to watch it, and where the conflict in the program comes from.
Well, our show is the first Black Lightning is our TV show is an appropriation on a 1977 comic from DC, mm-hmm. a DC comic that is based on the first Black African-American superhero family. So you have your lead character being Jefferson Pierce, who's a principal in an inner city high school that is dealing with the troubles that go on in inner city high schools, whether it be gangs, drugs, violence, social issues, educational issues. He's dealing with that by day as a principal in this high school. And then at night, because of what's also happening in the community and also influencing a lot of the children in the community, he's able to become this superhero, mm-hmm. and fight off the some of the major happenings in crime and corruption you know, with a more of an ironclad, if you will, right? And so you get a duality in this man, actually, you know what I'm saying, where you have him and you get a conflict in him where Jefferson Pierce is, again, you know, stable and secure principal mm-hmm. by day, you know, and then, you know, in some ways considered vigilante superhero at night.
Step out of the car.
Officer, my name is Jefferson Pierce.
Get out, please.
Okay, look, this is getting out of hand. Now, this is the third time this month.
Hey,
what are you doing?
Get your hands off my dad.
Hey, come on. Let me see your hands.
Stop.
Now.
Don't shoot. All right, everybody just calm down.
Okay.
He has two daughters who, through genetics, are also superheroes as well. And again, so you have an African-American single father who has two African-American daughters, all having, you know, superhero powers, metahuman powers and strength, and going out into the community to fight crime together. So it's kind of like a family business.
And Marvin, this is your executive producer, Salim Akil. He is here telling NPR that Black Lightning really sort of juggles several storylines with important social contexts.
We're going to get into the proliferation of drugs. We're going to get into who, what, and why those drugs are in our community. We're going to also get into how do you raise or help your children who have special abilities.
So, Marvin, how in the world did you get a green light for that kind of show dealing with those kinds of issues? Do you wonder sometimes?
You know, like the brother just said and we just heard, you know, he is very serious and strict on dealing with the issues mm-hmm. that affect the African-American community directly. And again, for me, you know, being an actor, an aspiring actor, and having a history in music and where I've been very militant at times, through my music and very vocal about how I feel and about some of the injustices that go on in America. Yeah. And to, as an actor, you know, this isn't, you know, this is my fifth real acting experience, mm-hmm. I have to admit. And it's actually my second that you will find credit for on IMDb. And to be a part of something that is, again, historic and so impactful to the world and carries such a message. Again, I don't know. I know that it is. I'm a religious man. I'm a believer in God, and I know that it is God's plan for me, to be a part of something like this at this particular time.
You're teeing up a perfect clip for us. Okay. I want to hear you. Yeah, perfect. I want to hear you at work here. And this clip features your character Tobias with Lady Eve, and mm-hmm. that is a role played by the terrific. Mm-hmm. Grammy Award-winning singer.
Incomparable.
Jill Scott.
Indeed.
Tobias, are you a church-going man?
No disrespect, Lady Eve, but my life hasn't exactly led me down a spiritual path.
Well, I'm going to tell you that the good book helps folks stay in line.
Yeah, that's terrific stuff. I want to play another clip back-to-back here. To give folks a sense of your character, this is your character, Tobias, attacking another character to get information on Black Lightning.
You lied to me. You told me Black Lightning was dead. You said you personally saw the body.
I saw...
Look, I don't have time for your lies. What happened?
The body came out of the river where Black Lightning fell. How many people could have fallen into that river? I thought it was him.
What do you mean you thought?
My boss put the body from the river in the crematorium.
Was he dressed like Earth, Wind, and Fire?
What?
What is it that drew you to this character? What do you like? I mean, you gotta love lines like that.
Yeah, I really, really, really do. I love it. And you know, again, shout out to the Black Lightning Writers Room. They are incredible and have written an incredible story. Again, what drew me to the character was the ability to create a villain, arch nemesis of Black Lightning.
Yes.
But having a very human story, mm-hmm. and you know, being able to portray the human side of the villain that is in all of us, I believe.
Well, let me jump in and put a fine point on that. Your character, Tobias Whale, is an African-American supervillain with albinism. You, Marvin, are a black man with albinism. How would you describe the journey, first of all, in your own life?
Yes, sir. Well, of course, you know, I've been able to combat and defy some of the odds that were prematurely set and given to me, and I think that are given to a lot of people that have genetic indifference, people who are born differently, whether it be visually or a physical difference or any kind of handicap, whether it be something that deals with an inability to see or an inability to hear or an inability to walk. These things are given so much prejudice and bias to the world based off of what you're able to endure, accomplish, and give to the world overall. You know, with albinism is a genetic disposition that is something that only thing that really is different about a person with albinism and a person without albinism is the melanin in one's skin. So yes. the coloration or the ability to, you know, have coloration in the skin is very much so limited or depleted in people who have albinism. And also there's some things like low eyesight, poor mm-hmm. eyesight. Mm-hmm. Of course, sensitivity to sun due to no melanin. Of course, psoriasis, which is also a skin disorder. So these things have an effect on a person with albinism, but, you know, they also have an effect on anybody. I mean, a lot of people have low vision. Lot of people have sensitivity to the sun. The sun is one of the most powerful energies and the most powerful star in the sky, right? And it is something that we all should be protected from in truth. But the melanin, you know, deficiency that people with albinism have, of course, is going to create a higher sensitivity.
Yeah.
My point to all of that is that what a person with albinism is able to do a lot of times is given a bias and it's given a level of precaution that to me is it does no justice to the truth of a person living with it.
Yeah.
What I'm able to do in this role, in what I've been, the same thing I've been able to do in so many aspects of life, from me being able to drive a car, which is something I was told I would never do in my life, to being able to, have a career in the arts that expands over 20 years now, from music to acting, and to be respected for my craft and my skill and what I give to the world of art. You know, that is something that, you know, again, I know that I represent within the music community of hip hop, as well as the acting community now, you know, that is Black Lightning,
sure.
You know, this mainstream, television show that is the number two show on the CW. I now represent something that isn't always represented and to people who don't always get a voice. You know, on these platforms, and that's something that I take, again, humbly, and graciously, and I feel it's a great blessing to be able to be that.
I'm speaking with actor Marvin Jones. He plays gang leader Tobias Whale on the CW show Black Lightning. This moment that we're in now, Black Lightning's on the air, mm-hmm. Luke Cage is on the air. Mm-hmm. Let me have you listen to something here. This is from Jesse Holland. He is a race and ethnicity reporter for the Associated Press. He says Hollywood stories are diversifying. Here he is in an interview with the public radio show Here and Now.
And in fact, we're seeing a renaissance, especially for black superheroes. You have the CW with its series Black Lightning. You have Luke Cage on Netflix. So we're seeing Hollywood realizing that you can tell these type of stories with characters of different colors and gender, and everyone will want to see them.
And Marvin, Black Panther is a billion-dollar movie. How is this moment of black superhero success, how is it speaking to you?
In a sense, well, what it tells me is no one can stop what the Most High has planned, first of all. And second of all, it gives me so much, it fills me with so much joy for the generations below me coming after me, the youth that are witnessing this without the regard that we as, you know, mature men or men of age have had the, you know, the opportunity to know a time when there wasn't. Like that brother's statement was, because he has the knowledge to know the time where there wasn't. The youth that are growing up now that don't know the time when there wasn't a black president or there wasn't a black superhero on television, you know, or black showrunners or black woman director or, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
For them, it's, and for us, it is, like I say, we get the gratification and we get the affirmation. And again, for me, it allows me to, you know, carry the torch even further, wave the flag higher. But the empowerment that the generations below us, my dear brother, are going to come into their maturity and their existence and their young adulthood and adulthood, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
With this empowerment, I can only imagine. I just pray to God that I'm able to live another 40 years, you know, 60 years, hopefully, to witness what, you know, when we have something like what this brother just said, when you have a time now where, you know, the kid who is, you know, 9 or 10 or 11 years old or 12 years old, let's say even, right? And he was born in the Obama era, and he was, you know, in the era, right?
Yeah.
And he's growing in his formative years, and despite, you know, the clowns in office now, he knows the time. It's still close enough for him to know, or her to know. You're seeing the full spectrum, the 36 shades of black. You're seeing the black director, the black writer, the black actor, star actor, child actor, you know, and again, the empowerment. I went to see Wrinkle in Time with my daughter. I also took her to see Black Panther. She's 6 years old. I see it on her face. You know what I'm saying? The empowerment, the confidence, the, you know, when she sees herself, when she sees the brother kneeling to the woman, when she sees Thunder, played by Nafisa Williams, you know, stomping the statue out, when she sees it, these things are empowering her as even a six-year-old. You know, I can't wait, my dear brother, until Halloween this year. I can't wait, man. That's going to be like Christmas for us, man.
Marvin, it's been a pleasure. It's been a
yes,
real
sir,
pleasure.
It's all mine, sir. The pleasure's all mine.
That's actor Marvin Jones. He plays gang leader Tobias Whale on the CW's Black Lightning. The Atlanta-made series aired its first season. Congratulations, and thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Thank you so much.